We'll start today by turning to Matthew chapter 24. And as I had mentioned earlier, you know, we know that things are in a terrible mess in this world today, all around us. You know, and I don't mean to be a prophet of doom up here today, but I want to start off by looking at some of these issues that can be depressing, and it can be downright scary to us and to the world around us. I want to start off by looking at that, and then we're going to move over to something that's going to be a little bit more encouraging for all of us and that we can use, hopefully, to help us move forward in our journey toward God's kingdom. So I want to start off here in Matthew chapter 24. I'm going to read several verses. You can follow along or you can read them later. But starting here in verse 3, it says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" So the disciples wanted to know, you know, when is the end coming? What are we looking for? How will we know? And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." You know, there will be many false prophets, false religions. In verse 6, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Verse 7, "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." So a lot of terrible things are going to be happening. "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." And verse 13 can be encouraging to us. "But he who endures to the end shall be saved." So they shall be saved. We flip on over to verse 21 now of Matthew chapter 24. It says, "For then there will be great tribulation, such has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." So some pretty terrible, devastating things are going to be going on. You know, and unless they're shortened, unless Christ returns, it says, no flesh would be saved. On down to verse 29. "And immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and with great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." Skipping down to verse 36. "But of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark." And we'll look at this a little bit more as we go on, but what we see there is that in that day, you know, things were really bad. The people were living their lives, not worrying about tomorrow. You know, not worried that, you know, these good times could ever end. And verse 39, "And did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." You know, we'll see that with the society we live in today. You know, things have gotten to such a point. People are doing whatever they please, however they please. And to get into this attitude of, you know, it's been going on like this for so long, these times could not possibly ever end. You know, they're not worried about tomorrow, not worried about, you know, the end coming. In verse 42, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. You know, and that's a warning and an advice to us. You know, we don't know when he's coming back. And we're to be watching, preparing ourselves, and being ready. And we see, reading on in verse 43, but know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in at an hour when you do not expect him. You know, if we knew, the world knew when Christ was coming, you know, then they could wait to the last minute and make the necessary changes and be prepared. But we know that that's not the case. We're to be preparing ourselves now. And we don't know when the end is coming. And as we read there, it was mentioned in the days of Noah. You know, the people were living, carrying on, having a good time, not worrying about tomorrow. I'd like to take a break from that for just a moment, and I want to read a story. And this is a story that I have covered before in a sermon, so I guess in that sense I'm giving a Mockingbird sermon. But I want to use a story that I've done before, but I'm going to take it a different direction. And the story is one that we're all familiar with. It's the story of the Titanic. And I've done this, I don't know, several years ago, maybe not that long. But when I did it then, I relayed the account of the Titanic and I offered some lessons for us to learn from that. And that's the title of the sermon today, is Lessons from the Titanic. But they're a whole different set of lessons than what I did the first time. And there's only four of them that I have. But I'm going to read through this account of the Titanic. You know, and there's several pages here that describes, you know, the voyage and what happened to it. And I'll have to say that I've seen the movie about four times, and it sank every time. They never did figure out to watch for the iceberg. But anyway, I will read this story about the Titanic and give you a few facts about it. And this may take several minutes. But as I read through this story about the Titanic, maybe go ahead in your mind or on your paper, try to pick out the lessons that I'm going to give you out of this. And we'll see if you get them right or not. And it doesn't matter. There's lots of lessons to learn, so you really can't go wrong. And you can find some of this in the Good News back in, I think, 1998. They did some articles on the Titanic, so you can look some of this up. And I've also got a book on the Titanic called Titanic Unsinkable. As we read through it, you'll see some of the different attitudes that the builders of this ship had and that the captain of the ship had and that everyone on the ship had. So, on the freezing still night of April the 14th, 1912, the 46,000-ton British luxury liner Titanic was on her maiden voyage from Southampton, England to New York City. And about 95 miles south of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, she met her premature and tragic death. She had steamed all day at a speed upwards of 20 knots, covering 546 miles in the previous 24 hours. The temperature had dropped rapidly through the course of the evening. But the weather was fair and the sea calm, and there was a relaxed party atmosphere on board as more than 2,200 passengers and crew enjoyed the amenities of the most luxurious ship afloat. No rigid, organized routine was enforced. Passengers came and went as they pleased. This liner had everything you could imagine. No expense had been spared in the construction of this lavish ship and the lavish staterooms. Sumptuous dining rooms and luxurious smoking rooms had libraries, swimming pools, Turkish bath, gymnasium, squash court, and an 8-piece orchestra. And I even read somewhere it had a heated swimming pool on board. One thing, however, was lacking. There were not enough lifeboats. In fact, she had only 20, which was enough for fewer than half the passengers. The builders and owner were so confident of the Titanic's construction and safety features that they considered additional lifeboats unnecessary. And the regulations at that time required no more. After all, with 16 watertight compartments, the most luxurious and largest ship afloat was unsinkable. Or was she? Earlier in the afternoon of that fateful day, radio messages about ice in the area had been received from other nearby ships. As the passengers sipped their afternoon tea and ate toast, warnings were received from several ships. But the Titanic captain, Edward J. Smith, one of the White Star Line's most experienced and respected captain with 38 years service, and he was on his final voyage before a much anticipated retirement. He saw no need to slow down. As darkness fell, however, the crew did maintain a careful lookout. It was a cloudless, calm night. The air was chilly. The sea temperature was close to freezing. There was another ship, the Californian, that was 10 miles away, radioed at about 11 o'clock that there was more ice in the area. But the Titanic's radio operator, frantically relaying messages for the passengers, sharply told the Californian not to interrupt him again. "You know, I've got many more messages to send, and we already know about the ice." So the Californian ceased contact with the Titanic. And at 11:40 that evening, first class passengers still awake felt a faint shudder, a kind of jarring, like they'd hit something. One passenger later described it as like drawing a giant finger along the side of the ship. There was no major jolt, nothing dramatic to show cause for concern. And whatever it was, most passengers didn't think it was important. But shortly after that, the familiar hum and vibration of the engines and the ship moving through the water ceased. You know, the massive liner had stopped. And it was the silence then that started attracting the most attention. And a number of passengers went outside to see what had happened. And they were assured that all was well. "You know, we've struck a little ice, that's all. Nothing to worry about." But before long, some of the passengers seemed to notice the ship start to list a little bit, ever so slightly, but quickly dismissed it. And on the bridge, the Captain Smith and some of the others stood in disbelief as the horror of what had truly happened had sank in. Their situation was dire. The Titanic had collided with an iceberg. From first sighting to impact had been little more than 30 seconds. The floating mountain of ice had caught the liner a glancing blow, buckling the steel plates and opening a 300-foot gash in the first 5 watertight compartments, and they were rapidly filling with water and beginning to pull the ship down at the bow. The Titanic could not stay afloat for long, no more than 2 hours at most, they thought. The unsinkable ship was sinking. Fatally punctured, the wound in her side opened to the icy water that was rushing in. The Titanic could not stay afloat for long. You know, no more than 2 hours, they figured. And water was surging in furiously into the mailroom. And at 12:05, the order came to uncover the lifeboats. But there had been no lifeboat drill. No practice, no warnings, no preparation. After all, this ship could not sink. There was little noise, no bells, no sirens, no general alarms. The first class stewards went from cabin to cabin, politely alerting people, firmly asking them to go to the deck and get a life belt on. At first, there was joking. Passengers were voicing amusement and disbelief. You know, they really didn't understand what situation they were in. And Second Officer Leidler was placed in charge of loading the lifeboats on the port side. And he was insisting that only women and children could embark. On the starboard side, things were a little less strict. Everywhere there was polite confusion. And after all, they'd never done this before. They didn't know how to do it. It was now that the band struck up, playing ragtime. Perhaps this would keep people calm and happy during the situation. Some children started to cry, and a chilling anguish crept into the eyes of many of the parents, husbands, and wives as they began to realize a fear more powerful than any they had ever known. And on the ship's bridge, frantic efforts were made to reach the Californian that was only 10 miles away. But that radio operator was asleep, and he turned his radio off. Women and children were loaded progressively into lifeboats. Tearful farewells were made with the realization that husbands, fathers, and brothers might be seen no more. Some brave wives elected to stay by their husbands' sides. By now it was 12:45, more than an hour after the collision with the iceberg. An explosion of distress rockets flew high into the air, lighting up the night sky. This would continue for the next hour. 10 miles away, crews on the Californian observed what they thought were continued partying and festivities on the ship. They never realized or never even thought that the Titanic was sinking. And what they saw was actually a desperate plea for help from a ship in her final throes. All the while the band played, and the deck continued to tilt farther and farther. The lifeboats were being set adrift with their precious cargo of women and children, but many were short of being full. On the starboard side, some men were luckier, and a few were taken on the boats. The minutes ticked away, and now the deck is tilting precariously, and still the band is playing on. For the 2 hours until she sank, many radio messages were sent and received as the Titanic desperately signaled for help. You know, a few ships responded, but they were all too far away to offer any help. The Californian, the only ship within range, remained oblivious to the Titanic's condition and her plight. However, the Carpathia, which was 58 miles away, responded at 12:25. And promised to come as quickly as she could. And there's another story in that in itself, in that the captain of that ship had ordered all of his crew, you know, to duty or to work. And he realized that there was ice in the water, but his ship was going full speed toward the Titanic. And I think, as I read, he actually obtained 3 or 4 knots faster than what his full speed was supposed to be. But his attitude was, there's people in help, people that need help. You know, I know it's dangerous, but we're going to go help. But they were too far away to really be of much help. By 1:15, few passengers yet understood their peril and how swiftly the mighty Titanic was filling with water. It was inconceivable that the unsinkable ship, the largest vessel afloat, was really sinking. At 1:40, the crew on the bridge fired the last of the rockets, and the last remaining lifeboats filled. By 1:55, the last one was lowered to safety. In all, 705 people were to survive in these lifeboats. That left more than 1,500 people still aboard with nowhere to go. So only about a third of the people on the ship survived. And the band, which had finally played on and on, finally finished its last piece. These closing strains seemed to hang like ice particles in the frigid air. It was a sound that would haunt the survivors for the rest of their lives. The mighty Titanic, now filled with water at the bow, began to tilt alarmingly. and the stern soon rose high in the air, exposing the massive propellers to the night sky. Some people jumped for it and swam for the lifeboats. Most of them never made it. Survivors in the lifeboats witnessed the vivid and catastrophic end to the once mighty steamship. The lights, which remained on thanks to the diligence of the engineers, now blinked before disappearing for good. A hideous, unimaginable roar thundered from the ship. As chandeliers, pictures, glassware, and crystal came loose and shattered. A massive funnel broke off and plummeted into the sea in a shower of sparks. Then came a roar as no other, which some later said was the breaking back of the immense vessel as it was torn asunder. And at precisely 2:20 a.m., 2 hours and 40 minutes after she had struck the iceberg, the gigantic ocean liner died, sliding quickly into the blackness of the deep and plunging to her final resting place over 12,000 feet below. The survivors gasped and sobbed in disbelief. The final drama unfolded as desperate survivors waited and hoped for rescue. Many who had jumped from the ship in its dying moments were still alive, and they were struggling in the icy water. Those in the boats could hear them thrashing and milling about. From one lifeboat that saved just three people, the other boats never went back to help. The occupants were too fearful for their own lives. And one by one, the desperate cries grew muffled until there was a haunting silence. All those not in the lifeboats had succumbed to hypothermia and exhaustion. And the Carpathia reached the scene at about 4 a.m., shocked at the realization that the mighty Titanic was gone. They began to take on board the hapless, freezing survivors. And over the next few days, some 325 bodies were recovered. The rest had joined the Titanic at the watery grave. We see that that's a very tragic situation that happened. And in many respects, there are several things that could have been done that could have made the outcome of that a whole lot different. You know, if you read the book or read other articles on it, they ask a lot of what-if questions. What if they'd hit the iceberg head-on? It wouldn't have done as much damage. Lots of questions on it, but the end result is it was a very tragic event, and a lot of people lost their lives. What I'd like to do now with the remainder of the time is to look at four lessons that we can take from this story of the Titanic and from what happened to it. The lessons come from not only what happened to this ship, but it has to do somewhat with the attitudes of some of the people on the ship, various aspects of this. So I have four lessons that we can learn from the Titanic. The first one is to beware of the dangers of sin. Beware of the dangers of sin. Sin is very real. Sin is very dangerous. We are given lots of warnings throughout the Bible about sin and its dangers. And we, unlike the Titanic, we need to heed the warnings that we're given. They said the Titanic had received several warnings about ice in the area, and that if they had plotted all of those warnings on the map, it would have revealed to them that there was a strip of ice about 78 miles wide that they were heading directly into. But the attitude they had, even some of the crew members reportedly made the statement, even God himself couldn't sink the ship. They had the attitude they were unsinkable. We don't need lifeboats. Don't need enough lifeboats. Don't need the warnings about icebergs. There's lots of warnings that they didn't heed, didn't apply those. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 19. And this example we'll look at in Genesis chapter 19 is the example of Sodom and Gomorrah. And what we want to take from this is to show how dangerous sin is, and how bad it is, and that we should heed the warnings we're given. So we can look at what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah here, but we're not going to read the whole story. But back in chapter 18, Abraham is trying to intercede for Sodom and Gomorrah. And it finally gets to the point where if they can just find 10 people there, they'll spare the city. And then in verse 1 of chapter 19, the two angels come to Sodom in the evening. And Lot was sitting in the gate. And when Lot saw them, he arose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground and said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night, wash your feet, and you may rise early and go on your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the open square." And as you read on down, verse 4, "Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, 'Where are the men who came to you? Bring them out, that we may know them carnally.'" So Sodom is a very, very terrible place. You know, people are living in tremendous sin, you know, doing all kinds of despicable and terrible things. You know, very wicked, wicked place. And again, the attitude may be here among these people that, you know, we've been living this way, we've been doing this for so long, you know, how could it possibly ever come to an end? You know, we'll just keep living this way, keep having a good time, keep doing what we want. Yeah. But that's not to be. We read on, skip over part of that story, but getting on down to verse 13. "For we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." In verse 24, "And the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew," or note in my margin says, "devastated those cities." You know, destroyed those cities. "All the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground." So here was a group of people that was living a wicked, wicked life. You know, and they were living in sin, didn't heed the warnings. And we see what happened to them. You know, they were destroyed. One other example, we turn back to Genesis chapter 6. This is the story of Noah and the flood. Genesis chapter 6. We'll start in verse 5. "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, 'I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry I have made them.'" Now here's a group of people that are living in sin, living contrary to God's way. And it's so bad and so awful, you know, that God makes the statement that, "I'm sorry I made them. You know, wish I hadn't made them. I'm going to destroy them." But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. You know, and it would be a You know, a terrible thought to think that we could ever do something so terrible that God had that same thought about us. You know, I'm really sorry that I made him, or I'm sorry that I made her. You know, I want to destroy them. And we know the way the rest of the story goes. You know, Noah made the ark. That was the lifeboat, if you will, for him and his family. You know, and he worked very hard on that boat. And while he was working on the ark, you know, the people around him were probably laughing, making fun of him. You know, what's this crazy old man doing? You know, they were continuing on in their lives, maybe again with the same attitude. You know, we've been doing this for so long. You know, how can it possibly come to an end? You know, we're going to continue to live this way, not worry about tomorrow. You know, things are good. We're going to keep having a good time, not to worry about it. But we see the end of the story. You know, Noah finally completed the ark, and he and his family went in, and then the rains began. The floods came, and all of those people were destroyed. They were drowned. They didn't make it into the lifeboat that Noah did. You know, and as we'll see as we progress through this split sermon, that our goal is to make it into the lifeboat. So this first lesson, you know, beware of the dangers of sin. You know, sin is real and it's dangerous. We're to heed the warnings that we read in the Bible about sin. And we know that sin is very deadly, has deadly results to it. You might also look at the icy waters that the Titanic was sailing through. The icy waters and the icebergs, that can represent for you and I the danger that sin poses for us. You know, the Titanic chose to ignore the warnings. You know, they were steaming full speed ahead, trying to reach their goal, not worried about the icebergs. You know, but there was danger lurking in the water for them. And that's the way sin is for you and I. It's lurking for us. You know, we have to heed the warnings, be on the lookout for it. And again, we could think of these icy waters and the icebergs representing that danger for us. But let's move on to the second lesson. The second lesson that we can learn from the Titanic is to stay humble or stay grounded. You know where our safety comes from. There was not a lot of humility with the builders of the Titanic. Not a lot of builders with those engineers and with the captain. They even said that God himself couldn't sink the ship. You know, they were unsinkable, indestructible. You know, but we have to realize that we are not unsinkable. You and I are not unsinkable. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16. We get a look here, a little bit more insight to the attitude and the mind that could have been going on in some of the people in Sodom and Gomorrah. Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 49 says, "Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. And therefore I took them away as I saw fit." This attitude of pride and arrogance, you know, was one of the problems. You know, they weren't humble. You know, you and I have to make sure that we don't fall into this trap of pride and arrogance. To 2 Peter chapter 2. We need to stay grounded, realize where our protection comes from. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 2. And verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. In verse 9, then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. But to realize that God can deliver us and take care of us, we realize that we are not unsinkable. We have to have help. We have to realize that our protection, our safety net, our lifeboat comes from God. That's the only hope that we have. But the second lesson is to stay humble and stay grounded in knowing where our safety comes from. Move on to the third lesson that we can learn. And that is to stand out from the crowd or resist evil. While we're here in 2 Peter, we'll move over to 2 Peter chapter 3. But one of the things you see in the example of Sodom and Gomorrah and of Noah's time, that the people were living their lives, you know, eating, drinking, carrying on as they were. Everybody going along with each other. You know, we are to be different. You know, we're to stand out from the crowd, to resist evil. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 11. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? You know, what type of person is God looking for? What type of people should we be? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Verse 13. Nevertheless, we, according to His promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. We know that God's way is going to triumph over the way of the world, over the way of sin, and over the way of evil. You know, and we are to be one that stands out from the crowd in resisting the evil. The final lesson, number 4. A day of reckoning is coming. And again, as we mentioned in the example of Sodom and Gomorrah and Noah's time, the people weren't worried about an end coming to their lifestyles. They were living, carrying on, having fun, not worried about anything happening to them. You know, they weren't afraid of what was coming. Let's turn to Romans chapter 3. Romans chapter 3. Beginning up in verse 18. There is no fear of God before their eyes. You know, they weren't, because they hadn't heeded the warnings, but they weren't afraid. They weren't aware, you know, of how bad their situation was. That a day of reckoning is coming. Flip back to Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30. And in verse 9, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children who will not hear the law of the Lord, who say to the seers, do not see, and to the prophets, don't prophesy to us right things. They didn't want to hear about it. The attitude, I don't want to hear about it. I want to carry on with what I'm doing. Speak to us smooth things. Prophesy deceits. Get out of the way. Turn aside from the path. Cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. Therefore this iniquity shall be to you, verse 13, like a breach ready to fall, a bulge in a high wall whose breaking comes suddenly in an instant, and he shall break it like the breaking of the potter's vessel, which is broken in pieces. He shall not spare, so there shall not be found among its fragments a shard to take fire from the hearth or to take water from the cistern. So a day of reckoning is coming. You know, there is an end coming to these evil ways. You know, and the attitude on the Titanic was that it was unsinkable. You know, the atmosphere on there was, you know, carefree, not worried about icebergs. You know, they viewed themselves as being unsinkable. But we have to realize a day of reckoning is coming. As we read back in Matthew chapter 24, verse 22, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. You know, a day of reckoning is coming, but we can apply the lessons that we've covered here today. These four lessons, first of all, beware of the dangers of sin. You know, it is very dangerous, it's very real, and we need to heed the warnings about it. Secondly, is to stay humble. Remember where our protection comes from. Third is that we should stand out from the crowd and resist evil. You know, hold fast to what God has given us. Hold fast to His truth and His ways. And finally, we must realize that a day of reckoning is coming. You know, it is coming. You know, we don't know when it's coming. You know, we are to be preparing ourselves, making ourselves ready for that. We don't know the hour. Let's turn back to Revelation chapter 3. And we want to be using these lessons, applying them, to make sure that we can be in the lifeboat. And that lifeboat represents God, Jesus Christ. Make sure that we can get in that lifeboat. Revelation chapter 3, verse 10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. So let's apply these lessons that we've learned today to make sure that we can have a spot in the lifeboat.